This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thanks for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to talk about an issue that we've discussed before on our show, but there's a new reason to bring it back to your attention. Joining me by phone is Fenton Dooley. We call him Finn Dooley. He's a natural resources attorney in Bismarck. He's also the coordinator for the Salted Lands Council. And Finn, you've got an event coming up this Friday at the state capitol. Tell our listeners what that is.
I call it the first Salted Lands Day. North Dakota has had salted lands ever since the 50s, and we're trying to bring attention especially to the legacy of damaged lands in the old conventional oil fields. So we're focusing on two studies that the NDIC has done. One of them, called the Golder Study, they found, I would say, 216 of the 2,600 orphan brine pits. And we're trying to feature the legacy areas that have been neglected, and we're trying to really bring to the realization of the farmers that there's hope, and to the realization of the legislators that the state, because of its laxity, needs to step up and fund the efforts to reclaim these lands, to restore these lands.
Well, the first biennial Salted Land and Water Day will take place in a location that will probably get some attention. It's in the Great Hall of the North Dakota Capitol. The legislature is in session, so you may have a pretty good audience, huh?
Well, I hope so. We're looking for those farmers who felt like they've been tricked or deceived or neglected. We have Kerry Sublette, a man who's devoted his life, I would say approaching four decades of work in managing spills. And he promises me that he has worked in areas just as salty and just as toxic as the Williston Basin's salt. And we are one of the most extremely toxic areas in North America.
Well, we're talking about salted lands as brine spills, which is a byproduct occasionally of oil and gas exploration. And since North Dakota has had oil exploration for many decades now, of course, the boom in the 21st century is the one we remember most, but this goes back 60 or more years. So there is evidence of this, as you mentioned, all around the state, some parts of the state more seriously impacted. How did you get involved in this issue yourself, Finn?
As a boy on my grandfather's farm east of Glenburn, we were very aware of wells being drilled, and we always prayed, oh, Lord, can we get rich? None of the wells in the Deering area where my grandparents, Mike and Nell McDonald, homesteaded, produced sufficient amounts so that the wells were always plugged. But in Glenburn, and some of our family have married into the folks that do have wells, wells started producing. And then as a boy, my father, who was an educator and very interested in geology, took me to oil wells out in the Freiburg area. And then I began to work in the oil patch in Wyoming while I awaited the draft into the United States Army. I worked on two wells in Wyoming and two in Louisiana, one on shore and one in the swamps.
So how did your experience inform your advocacy for landowners about, you know, the possibility of damage to property because of oil extraction practices?
The first well I served on in Wyoming was in an area east of Bill, Wyoming. It was a deep well, and it was a very dry summer. It was 1969. We had one rainstorm, and the single rainstorm that ever occurred that summer overwashed the disposal pit, and out went all of the slops, including the salt water. In those days, they sometimes called them, actually we called them evaporation pits. They were not, they're percolation pits. So that rainstorm overtopped the pit and washed all this trout and corrosion. At that time, I thought it was really serious that the oil went over the top. I've now learned, and everybody in the farming industry with any experience knows, that oil will bioremediate. The Lord has made microbes that will devour the stuff, but nothing devours the salt. And when salt is very toxic, it kills until it is leached down and diluted so that plants begin to recolonize. That was my experience, and I had a botany degree. I had two experiences with the USDA in propagation of native grasses. So the interest I had from the family farm experience, my degree in botany, and my work in the oil industry motivated me to take on this project. It's sort of my attempt to be a farmer.
Well, in history, we've heard stories of people, you know, salting the earth, which would make it unable to produce any crops or anything like this. So when a spill occurs, what can be done?
The most effective thing is to catch it and dig it up right away. That's called dig and haul. It's very expensive. There are responsible scientists and farmers with experience that say that it's $1 million an acre, $1 million an acre. For the old legacy fields up in Botineau County, we have a really serious problem. How much can you dig? Cody Vanderbush, I'm told, has described one site. Cody, by the way, is the man at Lynn Helms' office that is tasked with recording and devising cleanups. $2.6 million for one cleanup, and I understand that they went down almost 15 feet for the dig and haul.
Wow.
What we're up to now is finding ways to address these problems where leaching may have gone down 30, 40, 50 feet. So how do you do that? And we have a very experienced group of scientists that meet annually, and one of them that I'd like to introduce to the farmers is Kerry Sublette, and let him answer the hard questions.
He's from the University of Tulsa. He's a leading researcher in brine land reclamation, and he'll be at the event Friday at the state capitol, the first biannual Salted Land and Water Day. So this is a problem for landowners. How about for energy companies?
For energy companies, looking at legacy areas like Botineau County, Renville County, and I'm quoting a hearsay statement, but it can be checked out. I believe it to be credible. The cost of making a profit on old wells in Botineau County is probably four times the cost of making a profit on wells in McKenzie County.
Mm-hmm.
McKenzie is dominated by the oil production in McKenzie is now dominated by fracking. In Botineau County, fracking has not worked well. So what they're doing in southwest Botineau County is attempting to nurture and bump along and pace together old wells, and many of them are not profitable. And the harsh truth is that many of the bonds will be inadequate to clean up, and many of the areas will severely tax and burden the state of North Dakota. That's the bad news. Many of the oil companies can't make a dollar operating in Botineau County.
So if you've got spills that over a decade or two or more go down 15 or more feet, it would seem that removing the soil and finding some other place for it is highly problematic. Is there financial compensation for the loss of that property, which will be felt for generations?
Well, you've brought up an excellent point, and that is, what is the consequence to the farmers? Claude Sem, a high-ranking executive in ag lending, the offices in Minot, North Dakota, has warned the legislature and farmers that lands with unresolved spills are not going to be worthy of a loan. If that is the simple truth, and I believe it to be so because he testified that way in 2015, what can be done to transfer those lands? One approach might be to cut out those areas where spills are and exclude those zones from the loan. So what we face is a really serious, serious financial problem. So not only is the bank, according to this testimony, and I'll be handing it out on Friday, not only is the bank unwilling to lend on it, but then there's another consequence. Lands that have a degraded productivity are going to lose their productivity index rating, their PI interest rating, which the agriculture department identifies. So we have a reluctance to lend on the land, and we have a lower rate of support through the productivity index having been forced down by these spills.
Now, it would seem that over the years, one of the chronic issues here has been unreported spills. But what you're outlining here is such a financial impact to an energy-producing company and the landowner and the state eventually that wouldn't the real incentive be to report a spill as soon as possible to mitigate recovery as soon as possible?
That's for sure. The quicker it's reported, the quicker the action is, the better the result. And more bad news. The use of clay, and I'm quoting Lance Loken of Western Plains Consulting, the use of clay as a catchment system has largely failed us. Sodium chloride, which is a prominent salt that comes up, does penetrate clay. He told me in person it can penetrate up to 7 feet. So what we are facing is a realization that many of these clay berms, which are said to capture everything, are not doing so. It will go right through the bottom. What we have in North Dakota is a moment, a very sobering moment. I believe that Bottineau County and Renville County will soon be what I would call North Dakota's own dispersed brownfields. Why don't we call them white fields? The phrase brownfield refers to this nation's corrupted zones, corrupted by chemicals, by metal refuse, by slag. North Dakota needs to come up to the bar and face the realization that many of these old zones, legacy areas, are not producing. It's eroding the productive community of the county and Bottineau. County commissioners have made that point to Carlene Fine. And thank God she gave a very reassuring response that the state is responsible. Indeed it is. The state didn't enforce what was known to be a real problem when the oil companies were brought here. Creating evaporation pits was the wrong thing to do.
Well, you have explained a problem that's been around for quite a long time, and I think we're talking about what is also recent development and why there wouldn't be a very powerful incentive for anybody who's operating an oil or gas well in North Dakota to report a spill immediately because of the financial cost to that company. When these companies go away, and as they have perhaps in Bottineau and Renville counties from decades ago, this is the state now that has to reclaim this land, isn't it? I mean, or else you've got a dead zone like the Mississippi going into the Gulf of Mexico. You've got a part of North Dakota where nothing's going to grow.
Well, that's true. However, many of our scientists are finding that there are ways to reestablish native plants. Many of the native plants are salt tolerant. Many of them will accept an opportunity to be propagated, and one of the alternatives seems to be to put a layer down and stop the bouncing. So in these interglacial zones, and that's Bottineau County, the water table is going up and down like a basketball. And so when one begins to address the surface by tiling and taking the salt out, you can decant the more concentrated salt and reestablish a plant cover. But because of that bouncing effect, you have to seal off the salt-contaminated underzone. What we're facing is solvable. The Lord gave us brains, and the Lord gave us chemistry. And we have an opportunity. And what the Salted Lands Council is trying to do is force some honesty. Deal with this problem. Count the acres. This Golder study is really one of the first efforts to even search for these 2,600 brine pits.
2,600 brine pits, and you say the state knows of a couple hundred right now?
Well, we photographed in the Golder study 216 of them.
So there are a lot left to be found.
Well, more than 90% of them haven't even been found. They haven't been photographed.
So,
not according to the protocols of the Golder study.
So this first biannual Salted Land and Water Day is especially important for people who think they may have brine-damaged land. Is that correct?
That's true, and we want to convey a debt of gratitude to the Petroleum Council and to Ron Ness. We want the petroleum industry to succeed. If it doesn't succeed, I don't know how we're going to pay for this. It needs to succeed, and it should bring more jobs to Bottineau County fixing these sites. At present, many of these wells are being pumped on a pretentious basis. They're pumping salt water, and they're not even producing oil. And why would they do that? Well, alternative one is they want to hang on to the property in case there may be some innovation in production. Another alternative is they don't want to pay the cost of cleaning up the mess. So they'll just pump it and pump it and pump it. And what we see is a succession of profitable companies selling off pumped out, wore out oil fields to less responsible, less resource able companies. And you said a moment ago about companies leaving Bottineau County. I understand that there may be as many as five of them have gone bankrupt. The state is the holder of that bad bag.
Can anyone report suspicious activity, evidence of a possible brine spill?
I understand that the answer is yes. There is a reporting system, and I believe that Bill Seuss at the Health Department is managing the Unified Reporting Service.
So there is pending legislation in the current session that addresses some of these issues, that is, finding more of these brine pits, correct?
Well, the expenditure, I believe about $88,000 that did the Golder study, was appropriated some years ago, and I want to compliment Rich Wardner for that one.
Senator from Dickinson,
committee. Yes. Right.
Well, you've mentioned Lynn Helms, the director of the North Dakota Oil and Gas Division, and Ron Ness, the Petroleum Council. Those are a couple of very important organizations in the industry and for the state. So you've got some powerhouse support for this.
I don't know that Ron Ness wants to call me a supporter, but I want to compliment him.
Fair enough.
My take on the Petroleum Council is that it should be welcoming real vigorous engagement to find these bad acres. And failure to do so despoils our land, and it's a breach of our stewardship duty. And I don't think Mr. Ness would agree that we should continue the bad practices of the past. And I believe that this industry should be burdened and the consumer should be burdened for the cost of repairing these lands.
Well, you sound like you have the legal and ethical high ground here. So what's the best possible outcome for you, for the state of North Dakota, from its legislature and from its governing bodies?
We've got to count the acres. You know, you got to know how bad it is. You got to belly up to the bar and know how bad it is. It's sort of like someone who has cancer. You really ought to know what the whole challenge is. That's the best outcome. And with funding and with research, you know, Jesus said, greater things shall you do in my name. I'm saying that the scientists that are out there fixing the lands are able to do great things, but they need funds. They need funds.
And people need to be aware of this issue, and you're bringing awareness to the state capitol on Friday from 9 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon, the first biannual Salted Land and Water Day in the Great Hall of the North Dakota Capitol. And, Finn, this is biannual, so when's your next big day?
I recently attended the 7th Annual Reclamation Conference in Dickinson, and one of the most astute people in this whole thing is Marvin Nelson. Marvin is a farmer. He works up in the area as a counselor to farmers. His point is this: let's bring these scientists so we can have an intimate connection of offended and disappointed landowners and bring those scientists to Bottineau, bring them to Minot, and have that conference right in the middle of the old disaster zones. Ward County has problems, and Bottineau and Renville, all those folks go to Minot to go shopping. I think we should have our next conference in August, Bottineau or at Minot State.
Well, we look forward to hearing about that and following up with you. Finn Dooley is a Bismarck Natural Resources attorney, and he's the coordinator for the Salted Lands Council. You can find out more at saltedlandscouncil.org. Thank you, Finn.
Thank you.
Coming up, a Mark Trahant commentary on coal in Indian Country.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. The 2018-2019 season, Time Travel, continues with Time at Home, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, March 16th, at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium, featuring flutist Hannah Porter Oxenia, as we perform a piece newly commissioned for her and Beethoven's Symphony No. 7. Tickets are available online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. President Donald J. Trump had a consistent theme during his 2016 election campaign. He promoted the potential for the coal industry to create jobs and economic vitality, especially in rural areas, and it would power the country. There was a catch. Coal markets are in decline. Last year saw the lowest consumption of coal in nearly 40 years. Today, Mark Trahant offers a commentary about coal, its relationship with native tribes, and public policy.
Tribes control nearly a third of coal reserves west of the Mississippi. Coal has provided a huge boost to tribal budgets and created high-paying jobs for the Hopi Tribe, the Navajo Nation, and the Crow Nation. Some 25 tribes have significant coal reserves, either with production or with the potential for additional development. But coal is a dirty fossil fuel. The production of electricity accounts for more than 28.4% of the greenhouse gases that trap heat and make the planet warmer. More than two-thirds of that electricity comes from burning fossil fuels. That's mostly coal. A report by the Brookings Institute says the decline of the U.S. coal industry is the result of market forces, not a policy or a war on coal. And that's not likely to change. So the better alternative is to come up with strategies to replace those jobs lost by coal. Last week, the operator of the Navajo Generating Station announced that it had reached an impasse in its negotiations with the Navajo Nation to transfer ownership of a coal-fired electricity plant. There is one fundamental reason for that impasse: liability. Both the Salt River Project partners and the Navajo Nation are keen to limit cleanup costs, which could reach hundreds of millions of dollars. There's no path forward on prolonging coal, period, said Percy Deal. A Navajo is now retired and the former Navajo County and tribal official. There's no believable business plan you can write when the market signals that something like coal is simply no longer economically viable. Today, our nation should be talking with SRP, but about renewable energy, not coal. Most people understand that renewable energy is the future, and there's growing data to back that up. The economics of coal and other fossil fuels are not getting any stronger, and renewable energy continues to get cheaper. Still, this is a tough moment for the tribe, and there are no easy choices. How does a government help make a huge economic transition to renewable fuels? And at the same time, how do you preserve really good-paying jobs in a brand new industry? I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. You can read more of his commentaries and explore other issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, UND will host the upcoming Collegiate Drone Racing National Championship. And we'll talk with comedian Tom Papa, the head writer for Public Radio's Live From Here. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Prairie Dog Infrastructure Bill had its first Senate hearing today. The bill creates a new bucket for oil tax revenue that creates a new permanent fund for cities, counties, and townships for their infrastructure needs. It had earlier passed the House by a comfortable margin. Supporters are hoping the bill will sail through the Senate without changes so it can quickly get to Governor Burgum's desk. The bill's prime sponsor, Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nathy, says he doesn't see any potholes to passage.
Obviously, the big question will be the economy, will be the price of oil, because it is dependent on the bucket system that we have. If we go with the governor's projections of $46 a barrel at 1.4 million barrels a day, everything fills up. The big pitfall, the big question, and it is with every bill, is the economy and and how we do. But as far as the mechanics and everything else, no, I think it's set up very well.
Next week, the legislature will receive revenue forecasts from both the state's consultant, Moody Analytics, and the firm the legislature hired, IHS Markit. Nathy says the hope is to get the bill out of the Senate Finance and Taxation Committee with no changes, get it to Senate Appropriations, pass it on the floor, and send it to the governor. The House has passed a proposed constitutional amendment to remove the names, the missions, and the locations of the public colleges and universities from the Constitution. It's a measure that has been tried before, and each time, voters have rejected it. The sponsor, Bismarck Republican Representative Rick Becker, told the House times have changed and the university system has to change with it. Becker says it is not a measure to close colleges.
If a college needs to close, it will be determined by the economic and demographic factors completely outside of our control.
But Mayville Democratic Representative Rick Holman said the colleges already have the flexibility and said this is just another attempt to close some colleges.
This, if it passes, is a threat to their existence.
The vote was 56 to 32 in favor of the measure. It will now be considered in the Senate, and if it passes there, it will go to the ballot in 2020. And according to a survey, North Dakota is the eighth best state for higher income earners when it comes to taxes. Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for WalletHub, a personal finance website. She says each state was looked at when it comes to sales taxes, property taxes, and income taxes. She says as far as high and middle income earners, North Dakota ranks in the top half.
For high income earners in North Dakota, only about 6% of their total income goes to taxes, and that's income, sales, property. For the middle class, it's still not as bad. Around 8.5% goes toward taxes every year.
North Dakota's middle-income earners ranked 12th on the survey. Gonzalez says the low-income earners in North Dakota ranked toward the middle of the rankings at 26th, with just under 10% of their income going toward taxes every year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Paul Snyder, Assistant Chair and Director of the Unmanned Aircraft System Program at UND's School of Aerospace Sciences. He joins us from our studio in Grand Forks. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And with you, Jordan Kruger. Jordan is the president of UND's Unmanned Aircraft Systems Radio Control Club. Jordan, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
And the reason we're talking to the two of you is because there's a big competition coming up to the campus of UND in April. It's the Collegiate Drone Racing Association's National Championship. Paul, what is the purpose of collegiate drone racing?
Well, I think the thing that I think about is excellence in competition. And so it's an opportunity for colleges to compete all across the country and to come here to Grand Forks, North Dakota and compete and really to test their skills, but also that just that idea of excellent in competition. So this is the start of something that we want to do at UND Aerospace more and more.
How many schools do you expect to compete?
We're around 25 schools is what we're thinking is going to be coming, probably anywhere from 100 to 120 participants.
Well, this is not brand new, but it's relatively new. What's UND's history in drone racing?
You know what? I think I'll give that one to Jordan. He's been a big part of drone racing, and he's an actual racer, so I'll hand it off to him.
Absolutely. So UND's history in drone racing, the last 2 years, Purdue University has actually hosted the Collegiate Drone Racing Championship. So it started up 2 years ago. UND's involvement in that has expanded quite a bit just over the last 2 years, and now we're hosting the event. So the first year, the UASRC Club technically was not a registered club. There was a little bit of inactivity, and we kind of sparked things, got stuff going, had a couple of racers come to the first race. We took 13th as a school out of 25 schools, and our highest individual pilot was 14th overall. The second year, we improved to a fifth place finish as a school, and then 14th for an individual. And now this year, it's on home turf, so we're looking to go shoot for the moon.
Well, I was flipping channels of a couple of months ago, and I saw drone racing, televised drone racing. What's it like to race, Jordan?
So actually what you see on TV is pretty close to what we're doing. The pilots hold a controller that's in contact with their aircraft. That's what's actually controlling it, you know, making it turn, pitch, roll, go fast, go slow.
And these things move.
They move very quick. So actually the ones on TV, DRL, Drone Racing League from ESPN, those aircraft are heavier, larger, and slower than what we're flying. And they are built by DRL. The aircraft that students fly at this championship, they're built by the students. They pick out the parts. They put them together. These aircraft fly 100 miles an hour. They can accelerate to 100 miles an hour in a half a second. And they can get to 400 feet AGL in 2 seconds. They are absolutely amazing to watch.
And they, this is very fast, even the slow version I saw. And they have to do various maneuvers. They have to go through various obstacles, don't they?
They do, yeah. So the course is actually set to push pilot skill to the absolute limits. And as well as their aircraft, there's hairpin turns, there's, you know, split S, large loops, and along with that, pretty significant crashes. But these aircraft are made out of, I mean, very durable carbon fiber. I've personally flown them into trees at 80 miles an hour, had it bounce back off, and then continue flying.
Well, and you are wearing these first-person goggles, so you get a view of what the drone's seeing as you're going
exactly.
very fast. And if it's televised, we do too. Paul, is this going to be televised?
Well, actually, yes, we're going to have it live streaming. So we have live streaming on the Internet, so people will be able to go online and watch the event as well. But it'll also be available for them to come in. It's going to be a community event where there is no cost, and people are able to come in and to watch and to see what's happening.
Paul, you direct UND's Unmanned Aircraft Systems program. What's the scope of it now, and how much bigger can it get?
Oh, wow. How much bigger can it get? I think it can get a lot bigger, but we're doing pretty well right now. As far as the scope, we're about 200 students in our UAS program, and that dwarfs our manned aircraft line, where we have about 1,400 students in our commercial aviation. But there's definitely job opportunities and people that are interested in getting into the field, so it's pretty exciting.
Well, we saw a big drone flying over downtown Fargo today, and we've seen them before quite a few times. Are unmanned systems the major growth area for aviation right now?
You know, I think that they play a huge role in that. I think as we continue to go to autonomous systems, you're going to see more and more unmanned aircraft flying around. But the thing is, you don't forget where this all came from. All the things that we've learned in aviation play such a huge role in it. So aviation as a whole is going to grow because of unmanned aircraft systems.
Well, you can do things with drones that you cannot do with a pilot in an aircraft.
That is absolutely
certainly,
correct.
Certainly.
And Jordan, what's your career goal, considering that you're now competitively flying drones?
So I'm actually going a slightly different route. My time at UND has allowed me to gain an internship with General Atomics, a large UAS company. And actually, you were talking about a drone or unmanned aircraft flying over the Fargo airport. That's a Reaper that General Atomics actually operates out of Fargo. So mm-hmm. I'll be doing something similar to that. I'll actually be going to the program management side of things, and that's pretty well set in stone. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I've had a lot of fun interning with General Atomics the last two summers. And, I mean, this is a hobby for me. This racing is it's a passion, really, is what it boils down to. It's been pushing me to really make this event succeed, grow the club, and, you know, interest others.
Paul, how did UND get the national championship?
Well, the last 2 years has been down at Purdue University, and Jordan's been a very big part of that program in the last 2 years. And so really his connection with the UAS program and us talking, saying this would be a great thing to get up to UND, is where it started. And the president of UND has really supported this and really wants to make this happen as well. And so he showed a big interest in making this happen and really pushed us to go forward with it.
Now, this takes place in April, mid-April, Saturday, April 13th. You'll have some stuff going on, and then there are more dates after that. So do you expect spectators, and are there safety issues with watching something like this with things flying around at 100 miles an hour?
So we definitely expect spectators at this event. The safety aspect, we're going to have netting covering basically the entire spectator area. So there will be absolute minimal risk to anybody else, including the pilots. We'll all be on the other side of the netting so that, people don't get seriously injured, because these things are, you know, real. They hurt.
Well, this competition is taking place at the University of North Dakota's High Performance Center. Paul, you've got some sponsors for this, and it occurs to me, I've seen this on TV. It's on ESPN. Is this a possible revenue generator in the future for the university or wherever this competition takes place?
You know, I think so, and I think we got to think further. It's a grassroots movement, but kind of think further than where we're at right now, where we could be testing the limits of unmanned aircraft and autonomous systems. We could be doing competitions on counter UAS. We could do competitions on precision and other things like that that really could bring in, sponsorships and possible revenue.
Jordan, you mentioned that you get to build your own drones and that you can, you know, obviously make some performance modifications to them. How competitive do you think your drone's going to be? What kinds of things can you do?
So actually, all of the pilots are really limited by the current technology. And, well, when I say current technology, there's one important aspect of these aircraft that limits us, and that's battery. With the absolute best performing motors that put out the most thrusts, you know, we can go the fastest if the pilot's skill is there. They suck the juice out of the batteries quicker than you can actually last for a race. So each race is 2 minutes long, and if you're pushing it at 100% throttle the entire time, the aircraft will last for 30 seconds, and then it will basically drop out of the sky.
So there's some strategy here.
Yes. Now, so it's almost an endurance race in that aspect.
Now, when I saw this, I saw what looked like a series of heats with points and standings throughout, and then the person with the best point standing wins. Is that the way this is done too?
Yeah, that's the basic concept for it. You know, we'll go through heats, which is a couple races, and, you know, there's eight pilots in each race. And at the end of it, we're taking basically the best three races, the times on that, and how many laps pilot gets. And then from there, you would just put them on a leaderboard, and, you know, whoever's at the top basically takes the cake.
Well, I'll be going online to watch this. Paul, UND's Aerospace Sciences program is a big deal, has been for many years now. This UAS thing is a rather recent addition to it. Mm-hmm. Who are the major competitors in higher ed in the United States for the students you're looking for?
Yeah, I would say Embry-Riddle is a competitor in that regard. They have a great program as well, maybe a little bit of a different cost structure than we do. Being a public institution, but they have some great people there doing some good work. I'm also going to Kansas, probably Kansas State, does some great work as well as unmanned aircraft systems. I think Purdue is trying to do some things in unmanned aircraft systems, Liberty University. So there's a few out there that are trying to do it as well. We were the first ones to have a four-year degree program back in 2009, which Ben Trapnell, and who's also all still a part of our faculty, got started. And so we're actually at our 10-year anniversary for unmanned aircraft systems degree. So it's pretty cool.
And, of course, the university has the benefit of being in North Dakota, which has one of these unmanned aircraft systems experimental or research zones, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we have the Research Institute of Autonomous Systems through the university, which is trying to leverage all the different parts of the university to further autonomous systems. We have the Grand Sky out at the airport, where you have Northrop Grumman and General Atomics that's operating. We have multiple small startup companies that are doing unmanned aircraft systems here in town and in Fargo as well. So it's just a great place to be part of this.
We've also got Northern Plains UAS test site, and, you know, Grand Forks has been called basically the Silicon Valley for drones, or UAS, and it honestly is.
Well, that's Jordan Kruger. He's the president of UND's Unmanned Aircraft Systems RC Club. He'll be competing in the middle of April at the Collegiate Drone Racing Association's National Championship in Grand Forks at UND's High Performance Center. And with you, Paul Snyder, the assistant chair and director of the UAS program. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, a conversation with writer and comedian Tom Papa.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by phone with Tom Papa. He's the head writer for Live From Here with Chris Thiele. He's the author of Your Dad Stole My Rake and Other Family Dilemmas, and the host of Baked on the Food Network, and he's got a podcast, Come to Papa, and he's coming to North Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your stand-up act. You're bringing it to the Fargo Theater on Friday and Bismarck's Belle Mayhus Auditorium on Saturday. The shows are at 8 o'clock. What will the audiences see besides Tom Papa?
Well, I'm bringing along my opening act, Paul Morrissey, who's very funny. And then I hit the stage. And our goal for our live shows is to make you laugh harder than you have or will for the entire year.
So wear a diaper, huh? Okay.
Yeah, I know. The biggest compliment I get is I almost peed myself.
So how would you describe your approach to comedy?
You know, I try and talk about things that are observational but will stick around. Like, I don't really go in for talking about the day-to-day politics of stuff or pop culture stuff that's going to work for like a week. I try and talk about things that are a little deeper and a little more connected to the human condition. And this tour right now, I'm really focusing on taking the pressure off of people. And I think we have to take the pressure off of ourselves. You know, everybody is always running around. We're all stressed out, trying to work as hard as we can and lose weight and do all this stuff. And it's like, everybody's got to calm down. You're doing great. Whatever you're doing right now, I don't know who you are, but you're probably doing more than enough. And, you know, I have friends in my life now that don't eat bread. It's like, why? You're going to lose 3.5 pounds. No one's ever going to know. And you don't eat bread? Live your life.
So does your act have improvisational moments, depending on the audience?
Yes, for sure. I really love connecting with the audience and talking to the audience. And it just centers, you know, I have my act, and that's great, and I have a message that I want to deliver. But I also want to interact and get back from the audience. Because the great thing about stand-up is the audience is half the equation. I mean, I can have my act, and it could be kill one night, and the next night it's kind of sluggish, and there's a back and forth. It's a conversation. So rather than just play with that energy, on this tour I've been opening it up a little bit more and trying to see who's actually sitting out there. And it's fun. It makes the whole thing kind of come alive. And I get to find all of the hilarious stuff that you guys are doing.
Well, stand-up is sort of the high wire act of performance. Is it a way to keep the comedy evolving and fresh? I mean, we hear comedians who go on the road to sort of develop new ideas.
Yeah, it is. It's constantly evolving. And, you know, I've been doing this monologue on Live From Here called Out in America. And it's been, I've been doing it now for about a year. And it's been great because I truly mine from the public. I'm out there, I'm eavesdropping on conversations, I'm trying to get little snippets of what people are doing from the places that they live, and I've been really using them for my monologues. And I realized as I started focusing, it was just a more dialed-in version of what I was doing with stand-up, but I was doing it more casually with stand-up. I was just kind of drifting, and you kind of find ideas and things, and now I'm that annoying woman on the plane who won't be quiet at 6 a.m. I'm like, go, sister.
So, as you mentioned, on Live From Here, your segment's called Out in America with Tom Papa. I encourage people to Google it because you're on YouTube and it's around. How did that come to be? How did the gig with Live From Here come to be?
Well, I was doing I always loved Prairie Home Companion. I just loved it so much. And Garrison Keillor was a true inspiration to me. And I started doing a version of Prairie Home Companion. I always thought, what would it be like if it was just comedians, if it was just in the hands of comics? So I started a show on Sirius XM called Come to Papa. And I would have music, and I would have stand-up, and I would have sketches. And I was constantly writing for this show. So when Garrison retired and Chris Thiele took it over, he needed somebody to deal with the spoken word because he's a musician. And a mutual friend of ours in Los Angeles at the Largo at the Coronet Theater hooked us up together. And I had literally been training for that job for the last 5 years on Sirius. So once we got together, I said, look, you're not going to find anybody that is going to be more prepared for this than I am. And being able to do the monologue on it. So I deal with the sketches and I deal with the people writing and trying to get all of the sketches kind of in place. But the Out in America part of it is the part that I'm really enjoying because I'm doing these monologues and they've just connected with the audience. And there's a whole audience of kids, like 12 to 15-year-old kids who can listen with their parents because they don't have to worry about grabbing the dial and something offensive coming over NPR. So all of these kids are showing up now at my shows, and I just am getting such a kick out of it.
Well, as a comedy writer for that show, you occasionally write for others. How do you approach that work?
Well, it's fun. Like, once you have the voice of the people you're writing for, it's pretty easy. The hard part is when you're writing for people who you don't know. And once you get to see, once you have, like, now with this new cast, I know this what Greg Hess is going to do, what Mike Yard's going to do, what Holly Laurent's going to do. I know what their strong points are comedically. So then you can start to dial it in. And the only frustrating part is, as a comedian, I write, I bring it up, and I can make it funny. And when you give it to somebody, it'd be like giving my 16-year-old daughter, just be like, okay, here, go out and make this sketch funny, and then you just got to sit on the sidelines. It's kind of similar. I feel like a dad, like, watching the kids out there and like, no, come on, do it. Then they surprise you and make something funnier. But then they don't, and you get frustrated. That part is a little difficult because, you know, as a comedian, you're kind of a lone wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really have to put it into anyone else's mouth.
Well, you're a New Jersey boy, and you broke into comedy in your mid-20s. So what were you doing before you started making a living as a comedian?
Well, I went to school, and then I got out of school, and I wanted to be a comedian since I was a child. I was around seventh grade. I learned that I listened to a Steve Martin and George Carlin albums, and I realized, oh, this could be a job. Like, there are grown-ups making their living off of being funny. And from that point on, that was it. I just wanted to do it. So I worked when I got out of school. I had a job in a small advertising agency, but it wasn't a good one. It was I was writing a lot of ad copy for nursing homes.
Uh-huh. Not a lot of comedy in that. Yeah.
No.
Well, you have been in the movies too. You played yourself in The Comedian. You voiced one of the characters in B Movie, the animated feature. You've worked with director Steven Soderbergh twice, and you've worked with Matt Damon on a couple of those shows as well. So you are well acquainted with comedians and performers. Anybody in particular made a very strong impression on you?
Oh, wow. The great part about doing this is that you get to eventually work with people and become friends with people who you just admired before you even started out as a comedian. You know, the idea that I would be like pals with Jerry Seinfeld is pretty insane. And I don't take it lightly. These guys are inspiring, and I don't want to just hang out. I've learned a ton from being around Seinfeld, from being around Soderbergh, from being around even Rob Zombie. I mean, all these guys, they're hard workers, they're creative, they're very dedicated to working really hard and being as great as they can be. So, you know, when I met Seinfeld, he was done with his show, and he was coming to the clubs in New York, and he saw me a couple nights in a row and took me aside and said he thought I was really funny, and that was it. I grabbed onto his leg and didn't let go for 15 years.
Well, that is a kindness that you often hear about comedians extending to the up-and-comers, so that's nice to hear.
Yeah, it really is. It's a strange little community where, you know, only comedians truly know what another comedian's going through.
Tom Papa is the head writer for Live From Here with Chris Thiele. He'll be in Fargo Friday at 8 o'clock at the Fargo Theater and at Bismarck's Belle Mayhus Auditorium the next day at 8 o'clock. Tom, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And any tips about the drive between Fargo and Bismarck?
Start early.
Good advice.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Decoded 8 Book for March 5th. On this date in 1836, Samuel Colt received a patent for a revolver.
His invention enabled a handgun to be fired multiple times without reloading. He formed a company to produce the gun, but sales were slow. Colt was afraid he would have to go out of business. But then the Army placed an order for 1,000 Colt revolvers. Instead of going out of business, Colt opened the world's largest armament factory. The lawlessness of the West has been wildly exaggerated. Gunfights in the middle of the street were a rarity. Towns often required visitors to leave their guns with the sheriff while they were in town. Few people were involved in gunfights or stagecoach robberies. But while the Wild West was not as wild as we think, people did carry guns, and the most popular gun was the Colt. It was affordable and reliable. Perhaps the most notable episode of Old West-style gunplay in Dakota Territory involved Teddy Roosevelt in 1884. Teddy Roosevelt was still new to the territory when late one evening he arrived at a hotel. It seemed like a rough place. He didn't want to go in, but he didn't have any other choice. When he entered, Teddy saw a man with a gun in each hand pacing the floor. The other patrons of the bar looked nervous. When Teddy came in, the man dubbed him Four Eyes for the glasses he was wearing. He called out, "Four Eyes is going to treat." Teddy brushed it off and sat down. The man towered over him. "I said you were going to treat." In Teddy's words, here's what happened next. "As I rose, I struck quick and hard with my right, just to one side of the point of his jaw, hitting him with my left as I straightened out, and then again with my right." He fired the guns, but I do not know if he was trying to shoot at me. He struck the corner of the bar with his head and was knocked senseless. Seems the man brought a gun to a fist fight and lost. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Bepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This area was hit the hardest. And as we drive through, you're going to be able to see a lot of vacant homes and areas that were bulldozed. These vacant lots here, there were homes here.
FEMA regularly buys disaster-ravaged property from homeowners. NPR has found those buyouts happen more often in white neighborhoods. What that has meant for one town in New Jersey. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, Zach Pelham, president of the North Dakota Bar Association, will discuss the attorney shortage in the state and other issues facing his profession. And a rift in the United Methodist Church regarding sexual orientation could divide the denomination and individual congregations. We'll discuss the issue with the Reverend Rebecca Treffs, who works with the church's Dakotas Conference. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.